Good afternoon, everybody. It's Thursday 1:21 my time. Welcome to Chatting Between Takes. I'm your host, Sean Benson, and I'm here with Damon Runyon. Damon, how's it going?
It's going great, man.
To you guys listening, you've heard me mention Damon before. We actually had to postpone a podcast. One of us was working, I think. We've been trying to get Damon on for a while. He's currently in the Toronto Star, just reviewed it this morning, 4-star out of 4-star production of Bull over at the Coal Mine Theater, and also the lead on Gangland Undercover, airing right now on the History Channel. And that's not really why we've been trying to connect, though. I think we realized that we just like each other and we have a lot in common. How'd it feel this morning to get the review?
Well, it was interesting because my neuroses flared based off the photo. Because I was like,
by the way, Damon's got his shirt up and you can see his 12 pack glory.
Right. It felt like a 12 pack of donuts to me. So I was a little self conscious about that.
So let's talk about that because I'm watching you on stage and I'm just like jealous of your hair, your fantastic hair and hairline.
Best
and
hair actor in the business, by the way.
Hey, I'd buy a house off that hair. And but also, you know, you're fit as shit, but you're looking at it not that way, which I totally get. Yeah. So what is that?
I was a chubby kid. So I think that never really leaves you, right? Internally, that there's always that, it's that voice, that inner voice that questions how you look and how you feel, right? And I know that when I'm feeling great, I know exactly what feeling great is. And there's, there's a buildup of guilt around certain decisions or...
Is there a buildup of guilt around feeling great?
Oh, wow. I never thought of that. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I know for me that there was a while, I'm getting over it, where feeling good felt like I was betraying this like vestigial, anxious kid who was more me than the me that feels great.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that's an interesting way to look at it. I mean, I constantly, and I'm trying not to do this so much anymore, but I'm trying to shift away from blaming my parents or lack of parenting. And
I know you've heard the podcast. You know I'm on the exact same path, you know?
Right. And then ownership of that. But at the same time, like, wow, my wife, Jody, we were talking about this last night. Every time anyone in my family, my mom or myself or my sister, who are not of my stepfather's family.
Okay.
Anytime like singing comes up, they always like just instantly ridicule our side of the family.
Really?
And yeah, and like belittle us and say how bad our voices are. And
still?
Yeah. And my wife's like, I just want to punch him in the head.
I do too. I don't even know them.
Yeah, it's but that's that voice enters into a lot of things. So I'm trying to get away from that.
So what's the lack of parenting or what's the thing? I mean, we're not doing therapy here, but let's go for it.
Well, I had three dads, so I didn't know my real father was my real father until I was 12.
Okay.
My mother told
me. Was he around? Was he part
of it? No. Okay, so. They split up when I was two, just before I was two, so mm-hmm. not really fully aware of who my dad was. And then my mom hooked up with who I thought was my dad, and then they split up when I was 12. And during that whole separation period, I was going every other weekend to who I thought was my dad's.
Uh-huh.
And that was rough. And something was different.
Wow.
And then she told me that, that's not your real father.
So you say to the third guy, you're not my dad. And he's like, neither was the other guy, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, when the third guy came around, that was around 13, 14. And he came in. He was only 27, which I never, you know, you look back on it thinking, oh, this was an older guy and you're 14. But like, that's pretty close, right?
Right.
Like,
so your mom was younger when she had you.
Yeah, my mom was 20.
And is that a thing? Like, how do you guys?
I
mean, my parents were. My dad was 46 and my mom was 36. So I have I mean, I got that stuff we talk about, like familial fucked upness that I'm sorting through, which, by the way, to the listeners, I just got to throw out. You know, it was my brother's birthday party this weekend. It was the nicest 5 hours I think I've spent in that house in years.
Oh, really?
And I had that moment where I'm sitting there and I'm like, you know, this happened too when I was a kid. Like, it's real easy to retell my story and make it real negative, which I don't think I've ever really done. But and I want to because I see the look and, I'm creating almost a fake relatability with people. I'm realizing because as I was sitting there at that really nice party for my brother, I'm like, there were nights like this too. They weren't all bad. Yeah. Not that I've ever said they were, but it was it was almost weirder, kind of like where we started this with the happiness to go, what if it was a bunch of things? You know? But having a younger mom, was that...
I think what I do as a default is use that as power, you know?
Yes, yes.
So I think that you owe me something based off the fact that I feel you're indebted to the responsibilities that you didn't uphold.
Right.
And then as an adult, I can use that against you and gain some power, you know? And I swan around on that.
I was spoiled as a kid, and I think a lot of it came... I'm making this up, but I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that, you know, we never addressed things in my house. So if my parents fought for 3 days, and then there was a silent treatment in the house for 3 days, it was never really talked about. Like, it was, we were never part of the deal. It wasn't like, listen, your mother and I, we love each other. You know, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But then, like, I could just kind of manipulate my mom into buying me something. And it was a subtle manipulation because I genuinely wanted the thing, but I think we all kind of knew this was a little agreement. Like, you get the whatever because we know last week was rough, but we're not going to ever talk about last week being rough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you get along with these people now?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing. I'm friends with my dad, you know, I try not to... to use him as a father figure.
Right.
And try to just be... I find the men in my life, especially the father figures in my life, and this is something that I try to stay away from with my friends, is that there's always an element of competition.
Sure.
And I was just at... My dad asked me to come and take some photos because he works at the LCBO at Summerhill, and they're fans of the show. And
nice.
His manager has like a wall of people who he's taken photos with. He said, would you come down and do that?
That's great.
So I did it. And as we're standing there, my dad's like, oh, is he taller than me? And I saw my wife just go, what? Why is he asking that? And then he's like, oh, he wore his hair on purpose like that so he could be taller. I'm like,
wow.
What?
You're doing this favor for him and his work environment, and he's still got to take the piss.
There's always,
so this is your dad.
This is my real dad. Yeah.
So did you, like, for example, partly because my dad was older, there actually wasn't a real competitive thing because even sporting wise, like by the time I was really good at tennis, he was happily like, I think you'll have more fun with your friends. Like I'm a little, he wasn't like 70 or anything, but he was just like, it was never a big deal if I won the game. He was more of an artist anyways, like a writer and stuff. So. Mm. There was always that intellectual challenge, but it wasn't quite like who's going to win. It was a stimulus. And right. Again, I think part of that's because it's older, but did you pick one of the three? Like is that, or do you kind of have no real father figure?
Well, that's why I changed my last name when I got married. So my adopted name, which was Bacon.
Okay.
So I was Damon Bacon, like up until I was 30.
Can I tell you that I think Damon Runyon's better?
Yeah, well, my middle name is Runyon. I was all like, as a kid, I was embarrassed of Bacon. So if I won like a trophy or
especially
whatever,
if you're chubby,
yeah, I would on the trophy, I would say my name's Damon Runyon.
Right.
So it was always, and I remember, you know, the looks I would get from my parents, but they let it fly.
Wow.
I guess because maybe they thought they were in on it. But so when I got married, I didn't have any affiliation to... I didn't feel close enough to either of those men. And I wanted to branch out and have my own name.
Wow.
And so we took Runyon as our surname.
My wows are really genuine because I have... One of my struggles in life was mingling myself from my familial attachments. Mm-hmm. Was feeling too attached. Like... I'm my dad's son and I'm my mom's son, like beyond my...
Oh, really?
Beyond a healthy period of time, I think.
Right.
And I think for me, that's what a lot of... And I want to seg into this. I think that's what a lot of my drug use and stuff was that I didn't know how to set up a healthy boundary necessarily, but drug use was a way to just put something in my body and immediately feel like my own man.
Right.
Feel like I'm doing this. It was like a mid-late 20s version of most people's high school rebellion. But
right.
I didn't know how to do that in high school. I didn't know how to go fuck you, dad, or fuck you, mom, or I don't agree. And it was that was a version of my escape. So let's talk about this for a sec, because You know, we were talking before the mics came on for the people listening about the idea of giving up booze and drugs for me. And Damon was saying a few people he knows have, you know, there's a sort of fire that comes from being hungover, from being strung mm-hmm. out, from being maybe for me, I can't speak for Damon's friends, but not peaceful inside, so that fire can actually lead to some good work. I mean, we're playing yeah. people whose lives aren't generally going the way they want them to. Otherwise, there's no drama. It's not mm-hmm. a real interesting show to shoot a monk
right.
on the side of a Himalayan mountain happy. It doesn't last for drama. So similarly to the thing with your parents, like, do you want to just be like, you know what? Yeah, I was a chubby kid, but I look great in that photo. Or do you like the fact that you have a link to a painful time, or similarly with the booze and drugs? Like, it seems like you want these things for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a kind of a badge of honor that I still attach to in terms of, like, I went through that and I right. came out on this side.
Yeah.
I know, well, with drinking, especially for me, I have a tendency to relax my rules. Right. And then, especially like when, you know, when you're playing a biker, who's hungover all the time, the joke on set was like, isn't this an amazing job? You can
right.
come to work hungover and you're actually doing the job.
I was fucking doing K-19 with Catherine Bigelow and Harrison Ford. And one day I'm strung out lying on the deck of a submarine in Halifax. And I look up and she's looking down at me. And then I'm like, oh, fuck, the gig's up. Like, I'm going to get in shit right now.
Right.
This is like my 10th night in a row out partying. And there's nuclear radiation seeping through our submarine. And she looks down and goes, oh my God, this is the best. You guys are having so much fun and it suits the role. And then Harrison steps over and goes, looks like you had more fun than I did last night, kid. And I'm just like, I have it made. Yeah. I went out for 10 more nights. It's fucking hard because it gets rewarded in our business.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Well, what we've been talking about is that internal truth, right? And that that inner monologue that I know I just have this, it's like a stench internally where you feel, I just feel this like self-loathing,
right?
And I can't stand that.
Do you want to feel that is my question. That's really the question I'm asking.
Yeah, I've questioned that a lot. Like in terms of you have those pitfalls so you can climb back up.
Right.
And
it creates its own loop of drama.
Well, that's the thing. I like whenever I've been truly successful, like book a lead or I get rid of everything and I'm focused on a singular task. And when you achieve something, another default is this celebration default,
right?
Where I did it. Like every night after the play, I'm like, I did it. Let's have a drink. You know, like we did it.
Yeah.
And then you can celebrate that. But then that's not the work. You know, the next day you got to come back and be.
Well, we're talking about something interesting here because I think I've said this to the listeners, but I remember one year I didn't get a series lead that I was like supposed, you know, I was told I was going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't happen. I was like, fuck this business. Fuck it, fuck it, fuck it. The next week I had 5 auditions. One of them, I didn't even read the script or the lines, walked in to meet all the directors, all the producers, and they're like, you ready to do the scenes? I was like, what scenes? And they're like, the scenes. I was like, I'm sorry, I thought we were just going to chat and like improv some vignettes. Because you know all those auditions right. we do where you improv vignettes? Like
right.
never happened, never going to happen, but I was just being like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I booked all 5 of those parts. Now, for me, it's twofold because I used to, my 3 series leads, I wasn't sober. Yeah. I was strung out. I don't know exactly what I was for those auditions, but I wasn't what I am now, which is grounded and healthy. But there was something attractive about whatever was going on with me. But what I think part of it is, and this is what I'm kind of getting at, is that in that singular struggle, I don't have enough energy to act. And I know that personally, I like acting too much to be good at it because I want to do it. And good acting is you don't see the acting.
Right.
And then for me, I think that's half the reason why I get to play the crazy guys is because we don't mind watching the crazy guy be a little bit playful or acting because that's half, I think, of the irony. But those leading guys, when I used to struggle, I was out of my own way. I'm just trying to get through the shooting day. And they're like, great job. And I'm like, oh, fuck. I was going to give up drinking tonight, but you just said great job.
Yeah.
Do you think that's kind of a bit of it? Like, you're getting out of your own way by tiring that aspect of yourself?
Yeah, I would see that. The clarity that comes with being sober is way more interesting internally.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I don't necessarily know if the character... I mean, this is what we were talking about before, where I've seen people who have gone sober. And, it's always like a varying degree, too, of like how addicted you were or how much of an alcoholic you were. Or how much was that in your work?
Yes.
And then they get clean, and it's almost like they become uninteresting, where there's like a dullness to the choice. And
I know that's because, I spent 2 years... I got fired from a job, and then I spent 2 years not really able to book work. And then I got sober, and then the next 3 years, I couldn't fucking book anything.
Right.
And I think part of it is that I was so bland and pulpy, I wasn't offering anything. And finally, when the footing started to happen and the integration of all that good stuff started to happen, then there was a whole new version of me, mm-hmm. like in what I could do. And I don't see a lot of relationship between my old work and my new work, partly because there was such a clear gap. So there's no continuum of me from age 30 to 35, really.
Right.
There's a role or two here and there, and some of it's all right. But I had to reset entirely, which makes sense because I was resetting entirely. You know.
I think also there's when you have that clarity, you get flooded with ideas.
Mm.
And so it's not a singular focus, right? Where you know, I'm going to play this objective because I need to be safe, or I need to not appear hungover, or I'm going to be emotionally distraught. Whatever it is, you access that. But I find for myself too, there's an abundance of energy and ideas that, I don't know if it's ADD, but it's just like you have all these things firing.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, that option. And it doesn't become specific enough.
So do you want both, or do you like the loop? Like, do you want to look at the photo yourself and like it every time because you no longer think of yourself as the chubby kid? Do you want to go, I don't want that to be my thing anymore? I mean, and it's a weird question because it's working for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're working as a lead actor in film and in theater. It's kind of the goal, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do?
That's a weird thing, too. Like, I think we should talk about that, is that this idea that you're working, right?
Right.
That I'm busy. Like, people are like, you're so busy. And really, my day just consists of like
coming over to
drinking
do a podcast.
Coffee, having a meeting, and then you go to theater.
If you have
and
time
it's like,
for my podcast, you're not that busy.
Yeah.
And that's not a denigration of my podcast, but we're self-supporting.
The other thing,
too,
is like that insecurity that runs through your head is that, am I ever going to work again?
Yeah.
And people are like, yeah, you're going to get lots of work out of this. I'm like, really? Like, I don't feel that. I hear that you booked the. Dark Matter today,
yeah.
And I'm like, I didn't even go out for that. You know, I'm stuck in my own little world of people think I'm busy. And
well, totally. And by the way, it might have been a role your agent passed on because you're a series lead. You never know.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all got our own journey. And it sounds like you and I might have a similar thing where, like, we're trying to shape something where we're not just taking what we can get. But at the same time, it's Toronto and there's a certain type and amount of work here. So when I get a recurring on a show, it doesn't have to be the best show in the world. And by the way, Dark Matter hasn't aired. It could be the next Battlestar Galactica. I don't know. Right. I mean, it has potential for that based on the scripts. Doesn't matter. The point is I'm 100% committed. But ideally I'd have just shot the series lead and maybe be doing a play or not, because I've got my own little journey that's going pretty good, too.
True.
So who knows what the ideal is. But I know what you mean about the busy, you know.
We like to work.
I love to work.
Yeah.
I love to work.
A friend of ours, so we have a catering business, as you know. And so we employ a lot of actors. And a friend of mine got sick, and he was the chef in our business. And so we had a friend, Carrie Smith, come in and take over for a couple months. And the transition that she went from being an actress looking for work to a person who has a job was amazing. Like, she was just radiant. Well, you know, she was so happy to be working every day.
So this is something, and again, I mean, if you're listening on a regular basis, you know that I have this sort of thematic through line of just like excellence and going for the good in life and not settling for excuses, you know, find the reasons. And if there's a real reason why things aren't going well, change it. But don't let excuses be the reason, because they aren't. But the point really of all that is the reason I started booking acting work again, 4.5, whatever years ago, when my sort of the Bensonnaissance happened, is because I got day jobs.
Right.
And those day jobs gave me a place to go. They gave me a sense of self-worth. They let me pay my fucking bills, and they let me take Emily out for dinner once a week instead of, I can't afford it this week, or pretending I could afford it and going into debt.
Right.
No, I work a day job. I freaking serving booze. I'm down at the print shop. I'm 35 years old. I've been a lead in on magazine covers, but it's not happening today. And I got rent due on the first of next month. In that self-worth, all of a sudden, that very thing I lacked for those 3 years of early sobriety started to integrate. And it was like, I'm a man. And by the way, that's when I transitioned into men roles and not young, angry professional roles, but actual men roles where, yeah, I'm tired. Yeah. And all of a sudden I could play a father who's got a kid at home. But I think that's maybe what your friends go. Like, it's a beautiful thing to see someone honor their commitments and gain the self-worth and sense of self that comes from it.
I think there's also an equilibrium that happens when you come to the realization that you are no different than anybody else, right? And that's why it's such a beautiful thing to get to act and to speak from your heart. Like, for me, I had this revelation where I'm like, where I wasn't booking stuff, where I was going for, I don't know what it was, but I was in a bit of a funk. And I started thinking, if I died and I didn't get out, how much, it's going to make me, how much I love life, you know, then I just feel horrible, you know? And so I started bringing that to my work.
Beautiful.
And that, that really empowered this sense of like, I don't care if you're a producer, director, A-list celebrity, whatever. When we come to play, we're equals, right?
Yes.
I'm going to speak to you from, I know you're just a person that's going to die, just like I'm a person that's going
to
die.
And by the way, when you come to play, nobody I've ever worked with who's, let's say, further along status-wise than us doesn't want you to make them their best by bringing your A game and treating them as equals when the camera's rolling.
Yeah.
There's to the listener, there's a thing called a call sheet, and the call sheet is your sort of order, your hierarchy on set, you know? Brad Pitt's number one on every call sheet he's on. Probably, depending on, I mean, he does the odd supporting role, which is part of why I respect the guy so much, but
he's probably still number one.
You never know. He's probably still number one.
Just out of respect.
And on a simple practical level, if Damon's number one and I'm number two and we're walking down a hall and we split up, the A-cam follows Damon. That's part of the actual hire. Like, there's a specific thing to it. It's not just an honorary thing. It sometimes can be a very practical thing. But nobody who's number one on a call sheet wants to be treated that way when the camera's rolling, unless they're shit and they might have a blip of a career, but they're not the people like the Clooney's and the Pitts and the Streeps who are like, give me everything you got when it rolls.
Well, Gangland was my first series lead.
So I want to talk about this.
Yeah.
Go ahead, but like, how was that?
Well, I mean, it was a huge learning experience, right?
Yeah.
Like, I came, because it was such an opportunity for me, that I was just determined to like to take control. And
you went and got a motorbike like within a day, right?
Yeah. No, I'm like, I'm going to be this guy. I don't want to waste this opportunity. But in the same sense, it's favored nations, or what's that term?
Yeah. Where everybody gets paid the same.
And we all had like the same, we had this big motorhome that we all hung out in. And day one, I get there, I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm 4 months, I'm going to be in every scene, and I got nowhere to decompress, and I got to go and deal with all like the neuroses of the competition. You know, it's a biker gang, so there's a lot of testosterone. And I think the second day I went to lunch, and the guy, the chef, was like, talent has to wait. And I was like, I actually went like, I'm the lead of the show, like in my head. But I thought, all right, my whole thing is was to not get ruffled, right?
Right.
And to be the guy to, because I heard this great story about
which if I can quickly interject, yeah, for the listener, he's playing an undercover, not quite a cop, but you're going undercover, yeah, for the cops.
A CI.
A confidential informant in a biker gang. So what you're describing is shitty as an actor, but kind of great as an actor.
Oh, yeah,
who,
yeah,
has to play that character.
Yeah. And the other thing too, I mean, I heard a great story about a buddy of mine was on Rookie Blue, and he went to the table read, and they treated him like he was number one. And I just, that story just, like, it warned me. I thought, oh, if I get that opportunity, I'm going to pay it forward like that.
Yes,
I'm going to make everyone feel special.
Yes.
Right? And I noticed with, you know, you have day players come in, and they're running their lines, and they're getting nervous, and you've been there, you know, 12 hours a day for the last 4 days, and this is day five, and you want to do the job, but you also know you get a couple of days off, right?
Yeah.
And they're messing things up for themselves because they're bringing tension into,
well, they're a so place worried about being
no
good
tension. Yeah.
And it's like, you don't have to be good, you just have to be.
No. So this guy Stephen McIntyre, who plays Kid on the show, amazing actor, and one of the other actors on the show was her first job. And she was a little intimidated by the whole process. And we got together and we were just like, all right, we're going to speak from our hearts. This is what it is. This is, you know, don't worry about what anyone says, the director, mm-hmm, whatever, like, fuck him, fuck everyone. We're going to go and play for each other. And that, just giving that permission.
Yes.
I'm like, you got it. That, I think that's the job of the
lead. You had a lot of improv on the show too, right?
It started with that idea, yeah, and then got eroded because people were coming not learning their lines. And so,
right,
the framework,
the story points
was
getting
muddied.
Yeah.
You know,
I personally don't love dramatic improv. I think comedic improv can be pretty incredible where,
yeah,
they spin off. But dramatically, I think you end up with a lot of fuck you, fuck you, fuck you kind of work.
Well, especially like, well, you know, you look at the play Bull. It's,
yes,
got so many weighted silences, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, it's in the script. People have, it says the character's name and then has a space beside it, right?
Right.
And it there's a couple exchanges.
So those are actually set up like...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it plays beautifully that way.
So what I noticed was, especially improving on Gangland, is people filling those spaces,
yes,
with like, well, plot or whatever it is, right? They're speaking to something that would have way more weight if you didn't say anything,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
you just thought it.
And that's the hardest thing. I mean... Dude, that's the hardest thing for me to learn in life. A friend of mine always says, before I speak, I wonder if it'll be more beautiful than the silence that precedes it.
Wow, that's beautiful.
It's fucking beautiful,
yeah,
and I don't operate that way.
No.
You know, I really don't. I don't know if I'd like to. I mean, I don't know.
You know what?
I like
I'm
the
just
idea
learning
of
to
it.
Sit in my mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, and not try to make it okay. Like if I say something where either I expose myself... Or I've made it somehow. It's unbalanced in some way.
Right.
My natural tendency is to be like, "Hey, everything's okay. Everything's okay." Like,
oh, yeah.
I didn't mean it. I was just joking or whatever. But to sit in that mistake and just to have that interaction, people just get deeper and,
yeah,
the relationship actually strengthens.
Well, this is even when I chat with the listeners in the audience. Like, I have caught myself saying "you know" a lot. And,
right,
then I listen back to, I always re-listen to the podcast so I can remember who I mentioned and give them shout outs.
Mm-hmm.
And I get embarrassed at how often I go, you know, and I was chatting with my therapist and he goes, you, one thing I'm hearing a lot is you say, do you know what I mean? You're very clear. You're very concise. It's not really ever vague what you mean, but you seem uncertain that people are understanding you and you need to verify it.
Right.
That's what the you know is for me as well. And when I re-listen to those podcasts, I feel exactly what you're talking about. Where I'm like, yeah, but part of why I'm doing this is to reveal myself. So if I'm still that kid, my version, which,
yep,
is I need you to hear me and know that I think I'm funny and smart and whatever, that's not the worst flaw in the world. And you can all have it.
No,
it's
no.
Okay.
I think that's the beauty of your podcast is when I listen to it, I think about how... You're unabashedly you.
Like, I appreciate
you talk
it.
About your Porsche, you talk about your bike, and or your watches, right? And I think those sometimes I get not blindsided, but I'm just like, I see myself in that,
right?
But I also think, oh man, I'm sure people listen to it and go like, wow, these pompous fucks, like,
and maybe they do, you know. I mean, the one thing for me is that who cares? Yeah. And it's a bit of what you talked about. I have a badge of honor. And by the way, what it used to be, sitting over on the couch is my niece, Sydney Dauphin. And what I used to wear as my badge of honor is that I had a black belt in karate. It meant that I'd put myself to a certain test. I'd looked at a goal that wasn't prescribed for me, like a graduation from high school. I didn't choose that. Mm-hmm. That was just karate. It was like the first thing I said, I'm going to do it. I want to be a black belt. I'm going to fight all the people it takes and do all the training it takes and show up as needed. I didn't quite understand what the depth of that was going to mean when I think my heart's going to explode from all the drugs I've done and I breathe through my kata. I'm not doing them because that might give me the heart attack I'm about to have. I'm mentally... The point is that the tests came way later and they were way different than I thought. But I have a badge of honor of going, I've been broke as an adult. I've been fucking hurt as an adult. I've hurt people as an adult. So if I come across as like joyously pompous because I fucking got to rebuy a vintage sports car after saving my money, after having been broke, it's okay because of that badge I feel, which is like, and you know, I'm real anti like pull yourself up by your bootstraps while at the same time going, get up out of bed today and fucking make some shit happen.
Yeah.
I just don't like the idea that I'm better than you because it was easier for me today because it wasn't easier for me 5 years ago when I was lying in my bed depressed. And,
I mean, it's not... I think there's a false... what is that? Excuse me. When we impose... what we think about someone else, right? And then, I mean, from this core energetics work that I've been doing, the biggest misconception or the biggest elephant in the room every time is that we perceive what other people think about us.
Ugh.
And we impose that on them. So we already have this like drama that's happening that they're not even aware of.
Well, and yeah, and now I'm aggro at them because I think they're attacking me.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be defensive because like, how fucking dare they? So now I've basically negated a whole possibility for, they might not be my favorite person in the world, but a good interaction, a present interaction, just being with them. But the other thing too that I'm hearing, and this is something I love, like, you're talking about this core energetics work you do.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, here you are. You're an adult male. You're in a position where it'd be real easy to go, I got my shit together and the world's saying yes to me. Why would I go take classes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what about you makes you go, yeah, but we still got to keep going here.
Well, I think it's such a thin fabric, you know, that it's...
Yeah, it is.
No, like...
You mean our biz? And like, yes, and the response?
You can believe all the crap that people say. Like, right. I'm getting a lot of positive feedback right now. And so my biggest... My default would be... And this is the beauty of doing a play, is that the following night, you got to go and you got to do the work again.
Yeah.
I heard Mark Rylance talk about it the other day. He was like, you don't go to a restaurant and want them to reheat last night's meal. You know, you want them to make it fresh.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And so in this work, even though the beauty of like film and TV is that it lives and you go, yeah, I did that. What? Let's watch it again. Yeah. How good was that? Yeah. How good was that? In theater, it's just gone.
Well, right? And what's interesting too, and tell me how your experience was for this in Gangland before we get back to why you get out and do more work, is, you know, when you start to know who your character is and you start to know that it's probably working.
Yeah.
Do you stick within the confines of what you know is working, or the whole reason it worked is because you had no idea what it was going to be, so you just put it out there? Like, was there a point when you're doing Gangland and you're deep in it where you're like, I got this guy now? And it was, do I keep growing them or do I keep deepening what I've grown?
That's a great question. I think what I did was I kept deepening him, just making it more personal every time and raising the stakes on what it would be like if you were to be in this situation.
Right.
And that level of not trusting. And the beauty of that role was that I could let all my insecurities come to the surface and speak through them, right? Like we do these monologues to camera, or interview, I should say, to right down the lens. It's like a 10-page monologue. And you're looking at the director, you know, in the loop lens. And you're manufacturing everything, right? It's you know, you're in this box mm-hmm. and there's nothing really happening, but you're supposed to be living this. And so the deeper I spoke from my heart and the more that I connected to that, the easier it was. And you could feel like, I think there's that responsibility of truth, right? When you're doing the work, is that often, especially on a low budget thing, if you get one or two takes, they're like, that's great.
Yeah.
Because they see
they got a, what they needed,
glimmer of what they yeah. thought they were going to get, right?
But they don't know what you're capable of.
No. And you have to bring what you're capable of in the first take.
Yes, absolutely.
And then go deeper on that. Or even, I mean, be as deep as you can on the first take.
Now, what does deep mean for you? You know, this seems real important for you. What is yeah. that?
It means where I'm not putting on the mask, where mm-hmm. I'm taking off the mask and I'm speaking from my heart and from my gut. And I'm really connecting to the person
yep.
opposite me. Like I'm sending the idea to you with full honesty. Yep. Or, you know, in the play,
yep.
I'm lying to you fully.
Yes.
But I'm committed to it and there's no exterior noise. I'm not worried right. about what the camera guy thinks of my performance.
Right.
Or like last night, I knew at a couple points in the play, I was aware of the audience and the fact that they weren't laughing.
Right.
And I was constantly fighting doing something for them. Or it also put me in my head to like think about the next line or how to send that. So the, you know, it might be a mm-hmm. different curve where they might catch up to it.
Yep.
But none of that had anything to do with connecting to Ryan or Diana.
Right.
You know, it was all...
So you're working more for the echo than for the actual connection.
Yeah. yeah. And I just got grounded and I meant what I said on the mm-hmm. next line. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay, that's I'm back. But that's what you're
Spencer
constantly fighting for.
Spencer Tracy was famous for saying, hit your mark and tell the truth.
Right.
And you can actually see him in Inherit the Wind when he's doing the courtroom stuff, looking down as he shuffles, stopping, looking up. And he's literally looking for his mark, stopping, looking up. But then when he speaks,
yeah,
in that movie especially, that guy's fucking telling the truth. It's beautiful. It's beautiful because what he does is he removes some of the artifice. Oh, I'm just going to pretend that I needed to stop here. So he's almost poking at, like going right at the heart of it mm-hmm. and then going, and now I'm going to fucking tell you the truth. It's, yeah. it's beautiful.
And it's fully committed, right? Like you have to believe it more than they believe.
Absolutely.
Know? Like there has to be no doubt.
Because you're just the guy. And by the way, part of the reason I wanted you in here today or soon is just to promote this show. Because we saw this on opening night, Emily and me and Sydney. And it's fantastic.
Oh,
I mean,
you.
10 out of 10, start to finish, all four of you, the performances are incredible. David Ferry, I mean, I've known him for 21 years or something since I went to theater school, and he's a master. I mean, the way he directed that, how was that for you? You know, I saw you in the play with Emily, and you were mm-hmm. really good. This play, you're sublime. The similar characters.
Mm-hmm.
Why the difference for you? I mean, it's a different production, different script, but
yeah,
I felt like there was...
I think there's... there's an evolution, uh-huh. definitely, right? Like in terms of your truth or my truth meter.
Yeah.
There's less showmanship now. Like I'm not going for what I think the character is.
I totally buy that.
I'm just trying to speak from myself.
There's a trust.
But also like David was... It was fantastic. The whole... It was, you know, and at no slight to the other production, but this was professional beyond.
That's why I say that about David. Yeah. I mean, he is a man. I mean, I know with the film I got coming out, like I do good work. I'm a good director, but there's master directors out there and I'm not one of them. And that's fine, mm-hmm. you know, but I know with what David's done over I don't know how long he's been doing this stuff. I mean, there's photos of him in the like early 70s
yeah,
as a teenager doing Toronto theater.
His whole direction right off the bat was so collaborative
yeah.
and so welcoming to everyone.
That's amazing. By the way, speaking of that play, Em, come in right here because we're just about to shift to questions. Emily Coots just walked in the door and her and Damon did this play together. And let's pull up your question, Em, and then you can read it like when people read bad tweets about themselves.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Okay.
I like your hat.
No, thanks.
What is your dream character or series to work on?
Whoa.
It's an original question.
Wow.
Big one too.
That's a big one. Yeah, like, Wow.
Like, if you create a series for yourself.
Well, I got this concept that, I think, I don't know if it's the best, but it's called The Distance Between Two Hearts.
Okay.
And essentially, Eros, the god of love, is constantly playing with the permutations of the distances between two hearts.
Okay.
And so he's navigating this this world of love, but at the core of it, he's doing it for this TV show that's happening in heaven. But people on Earth don't know that it's a TV show. But people in heaven are watching it as a TV show. And he's their host. And so people who have died who are watching the show might be waiting for their partners. And they may see their partner on the show fall in love with someone else. And there's always that that push and pull between...
The distance.
Yeah, the distance between two hearts.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Rules, babe.
Yeah.
Rules, babe.
Oh, nice.
Got it.
When, yeah, please do. You
That's
Diana,
fantastic.
Diana calls me Mincy.
Mincy?
Because I always have mints on me. It's hilarious.
It's not a reference to Christopher Mintz Plasse. Is that his name?
Who's that?
The guy from Superbad. What the fuck's his name? You know, he's McLovin.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure she's not referring to you as McLovin.
No.
So, by the way, here's a Diana Bentley question.
Yeah.
Diana Bentley produced and is in this play as well. And, oh, yeah, that's part of the reason I wanted Damon on. Please go see this. It's at the Coal Mine Theater, 798 Danforth Street East. You guys are going 7:30 to 8:30 every night but Monday for another week or another 2 weeks?
2 weeks. April 5th, last
show. You have to go see this, people. Go see. They also did the motherfucker with the hat a while back. This company is... They're doing the real work. You want to go see this, and you're just never going to ever regret your time spent seeing just the best of the best doing the best work. So that's part of the reason I really wanted you in here, Damon. So if one extra person goes because they're listening, it's that good. But what Diana wants to know...
And we will pay you the $5 that we agreed on.
Well, yeah. Hey, I'm getting my kickbacks, yo. We're not sponsored yet, but I get kickbacks.
I got you a mug.
By the way, Damon brought me an Anchor mug. Do you even know that we're all about Anchors? Around here, we got a big Anchor up there. I mean, we're in hipster Junctionville, so of course there's Anchors around. But...
Well, my buddy Ben owns the Anchored Social Club, which is a workout facility. And so when I saw that, I instantly thought of that. And everything that he identifies with is being grounded in Anchor.
Is it a lot of like Tom of Finland kind of guys working out, like all buff 40s?
No, not at all. No, it's brawny, well, it's essentially just lean. Like, not everyone's lean, but... He's super lean, and it's all about balance.
Nice.
And we do crazy things like monkey climbs. And
this is Diana's question. Okay. So despite any insecurities that he and we all have, Damon's in really great shape. I have a man crush on him. Emily pointed that out to me the other night. Mm-hmm. What do you – she actually asked it for both of us, but I'll ask you. What do you hate most when you work out? And then her suggestions were, is it ball sweat, ass sweat, or short shorts riding up?
Huh.
So it doesn't have to be one of those three, but she thinks it could be one
it's
of those
an interesting
three.
Interesting multiple choice question,
right?
Isn't it?
Shows you where her head's at.
Yeah.
I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah, the smell, yeah. I guess the smell is... You can't... So with Ben, I was going to say, that these monkey climbs. So one guy stabilizes himself, flexing his core and butt, and puts his arms behind his head. The other guy hops on his back and then climbs around him. And you go, you can, sometimes we go two or three times around.
Okay.
And so your balls are literally being squished across his waist or chest or whatever.
Hot.
And yeah. And so, yeah, so if they stink.
So it is a brawny 40s Tom of Finland kind of gym.
Maybe it maybe is,
You don't realize you're like where you actually are.
It's
like what is it, airplane, the Blue Oyster? Yeah, for me, Diana, I think what I hate most is actually finding time to work out.
Right.
It's one of those things where the regularity with which the real results come,
when do you
at least
do it,
for me.
You're a morning guy, right?
I'm all over the map. I'm going to go probably tonight at like 8 or 9 after dinner. Yesterday I was there. That's the hard thing I find is with all the different things. It's like I love being a morning guy, but lately Emily and I have been enjoying the snooze button a little bit too much for workouts. And I start like parceling out my day like, well, maybe if I don't do that one thing, then I can snooze for 5 more minutes. Because I plan my days out to like, I have 5 minutes to get from A to B. And if I snooze twice, something actually has to be canceled.
Right.
I should probably plan a few less things. But often someone cancels, and that's the best. Do you like when people cancel on you?
Yeah, I secretly kind of hope for it. I hope for it too. And sometimes I actually put out, I put it into the ether, right? Like, oh, it's no problem. Yeah, yeah. Totally. I'll do the check in. Like, are we still good? Hoping that they're not.
I'm pretty familiar with the "Are we still good?"
Yeah.
Let's talk about the motorbike. So you knew you were shooting a series lead. Yep. You knew you had to play a biker. You knew you were going to get a bike. I know we chatted about it briefly before, but you ended up with the Thruxton?
Yeah,
Triumph. Why'd you pick that? What were your options? What were you looking at? Let's go gearhead for a sec.
Yeah, I was always sort of a cafe racer file, I guess. I thought all the guys that I wanted to be like were riding those, and everything that comes with it too, right? Like the just the vintage quality of
it. Are you into the whole barber, that kind of thing?
I am. Right now I'm growing my hair out for season two, hopefully. Amazing. So so I haven't seen a barber. And by the way, my wife cuts my hair.
No,
so
that's barber, B-A-R-B-O-U-R. I'll show you some stuff.
No, I thought you were talking about the hipster barbers.
Well, I mean, that's something that you can, again, I thought they come happily with every Thruxton. I'd have long hair if I wasn't going bald. But no, the barber jackets, it's like along with the bell staff. I'll show you some stuff online. Yeah. And to the listener, if you want like some of the best, coolest kit, it's that sort of British 60s. Like, it's not quite mod gear, it's more actual utilitarian, like coated in wax for wet. You'll love it. You'll shit.
I'm on the Deus site all the time.
Yeah.
And anyone that is going anywhere, I'm like, hey, grab me a hat or grab me.
Have you been down there?
No, I've not.
Oh my God. Emily and I went there last time we were in LA, and it's right there on Lincoln Boulevard, like Venice, Marina Del Rey border.
As cool as it seems?
It's fucking cooler. We walked in and we're like, we don't belong here.
I've never seen so many cool people in one room.
Really?
A little bit annoying.
Have you seen the Bally? They have on YouTube, they have like a 3-minute sort of, they walk through the whole, it's a huge place, man. It's like, I don't know, it looks like about 3 or 4 acres. And they have a photo studio, they have, it looks like a
model. Where's this at?
In Bali, Indonesia.
Oh no, I didn't know they had one.
Yeah, it's huge.
Oh, that's amazing.
They do custom surfboards, bikes, they have a huge restaurant.
It's great stuff. And by the way, Town Moto in town.
Yeah.
You get down there much?
Oh,
they have
all
great
the time.
Stuff. Yeah.
Ben's good friends own it.
Actually. Oh, awesome. Yeah. And to the listeners, Town Moto is just ridiculous. Like, I don't love the word curating because it sounds a bit douchey or whatever, but it's the most perfectly curated store because every time I go in there, I'm like, the thing I need wasn't there last time, and because they're not bringing in every single piece of gear all day. And I guess that's what fashion kind of is. I'm learning this through Emily, but like, fashion's when it's not just the same all the time. You're like, no, this is the kind of newer look that, and I'm like, I'm such a sucker for it. And it's, they have a lot of Deus stuff there as well.
Yeah,
they do. And Deus also, by the way, does this thing. They did one. It's a rotating, but called Luftgekühlt, which is German for air-cooled.
Right.
And so they had this fucking Porsche, like, extravaganza where like 50 old vintage Porsches went there. And I'm like, just when I thought Deus was pretty cool, they go and do that.
I know.
So I'm kind of
Have you seen
board.
Those posters?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those sort of amazing. Orangey, kind of like that one over there, but for the...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're all up on the day who's down here. So you went for the Thruxton.
Yep.
Had you looked at any others?
Well, my buddy Joris was like, if you're going to be riding a Harley, you should get a Harley. So I went out to the dealership and I really like the Fat Bob.
Yes.
I just like the fat wheels, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And then, I mean, when you crank the throttle on that thing, it's loud and smooth.
Yeah.
Surprisingly. The bikes on the show were all old and...
Were they rat bikes? Were they shitty?
They were rough. My bike broke down often, and it rattled, and the handlebars rattled.
Well, I was reading a bit about Charles Falco, and he was talking about how there's this really wonderful illusion of what it's like to be a biker, but it's like the fucking grossest chicks are actually the girls hanging around. It's not the hot Sons of Anarchy girls. It's like, and even them, they give them like a little bit of grit, and it's like, no, they're 10 times better. Like, he just talks about how shitty everything was.
Yeah.
And just like shitty.
Yeah. I mean, these are dirty people, right?
Right.
Like, these are like when you, well, any, I've read a couple different undercover stories, and most of the bike stories are about guys who are strung out for, you know, weeks on end, and they're not showering, and they're physically abusive to pretty much everyone.
Right.
And the guys we met in Arizona who weren't, they, I think they were all cops, mm-hmm. but they had their own gang. But they still operated on threats, right? Like, everything was posturing all the time. Mm. And this, like, it's just such an ugly behavior.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the film or the TV gang qualities, you know, that these guys aren't articulate.
Yeah.
And they're, they're packing their guns and knives, and they're willing to pull it on you at any moment, which is kind of scary.
So you didn't opt for the Harley?
I did not opt for the Harley, no, because I figured, what if the show doesn't come through, number one? And
you're paying triple for the bike. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it really was kind of priced out of my range.
Yeah.
You know, I got the Thruxton.
They're not cheap, man.
Actually, I bought the Thruxton off this really cool guy who's a customs inspector.
Okay.
And I took it out. I went out there and he was really, he didn't want to sell it, but he just had his second child.
Nice.
And
depressed his wife, markets. Buy yeah. one. Yeah.
Yeah. I got it for like $7,000.
Oh, that's amazing. That's yeah. amazing.
And I was going to buy it new, love but they knew it was like 11.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't offer me anything off. There was zero kidding? Financing, but no.
Wow.
I'm like, hey, I really would like to
I'm
buy it new.
I'm pretty sure Triumphs aren't flying off the shelves either. Like, they do fine, yeah. but they're not like...
He acted like they were.
Yeah.
But this one had the British
racing
pipes on it.
Is this the place up in Woodbridge there? Like, yeah. Yeah. I love that store.
GP Sports,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah,
GP,
I think so. Yeah. They got good kid out there.
Yeah. And I, oh, the other thing was the Ducati Monster was something I'd always, yeah, every time I've been to Italy, I've seen these bikes fly around.
Yep.
And you're just like, ah, oh, it's the coolest. But when I got on it, it actually, the weight of it, like it's very light, mm-hmm. right? It didn't for, I mean, I'm 6'2", like 190, and I didn't feel safe on it.
Did your nuts hit the tank?
Yeah. It was
that's
little
my
small.
Problem. The ergos on the Monster.
Yeah.
I love the bike. I love the way it responds, but I could never own one for my nuts.
I love the brakes. That's the one crappy thing about the Thruxton is that they're a little soft on the brakes. Mm.
That's why I went for the V-Strom because the Suzuki V-Strom, if you're listening, is basically like Suzuki's way cheaper version of the BMW 1200 GS,
okay.
which I was all excited to buy. And this huge bike... my fucking nuts. Like, it was like I was sitting on a bike one third the size.
Right.
And I'm like, what the hell? And then I sit on the V-Strom and it's perfect. The ergonomics are better.
Yeah.
A lot of nut talk here,
yeah. Ray.
Thanks, Diana.
Yeah. She brought it up. What should we talk about, Em?
The BMW I love. We did for Gangland, so a bunch of guys didn't ride. And so there's a guy in Barrie that trains on motocross.
Okay.
And so they took us up there. And so after a day of riding around on little dirt bikes, they were like, all right, bring out the big BMWs. And we took them out
amazing.
On the road.
Amazing.
I mean, I think I got up to 90 on that. And I was hanging back because it was the first time on the road for me. You know, I just gotten my license, which is essentially riding in a parking lot.
Yeah.
Right.
It is essentially riding in a parking lot. It's pretty crazy how you can just do that and get. And you know, I always bitch about this on the podcast. Like, I get a fucking speeding ticket for going 125. But I'm like a race certified driver, but I'm on the road with people who've only ever driven in a parking lot.
Yeah.
So you do need a lower speed limit, but fuck them. Let's test people a little better.
Yeah.
And then let's like let well, good drivers
just,
drive
I
well.
I mean, the temporary license is a written exam, right?
Like, and then you're on the road
I
driving.
I was like, what? I can go and ride a motorbike right now? Like as long as it's during the day by myself?
And you're like an adult.
Yeah.
And here's the irony. Because you're an adult and you have the capacity for more reason than your own self at 20 or 18, you're actually going, maybe I'm not going to do that right away. Maybe I'll have a... But it's the young kid who's like, great, I wrote the test. I'm good.
Yeah. I've wanted a bike since I was 16. And I thought, you know, I saw Top Gun. I thought, that's me, man. Like,
Kelly McGillis.
Exactly. That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And of course, it was always shunned, my family.
Okay.
And so now I was finally old enough to do it. But my wife was... she was adamant about not getting it because she grew up in Peterborough and a lot of her friends had major accidents.
Really?
And there was no one that she knew that didn't have a major accident.
Ugh.
And her dad had a bike.
Well, there is a pretty common phrase, which is it's not if you go down, it's when.
Yeah.
You know, I've been down on my bike 3 times. Luckily, they were all just me and I was avoiding stuff. I've talked about the one on the Harley, but it's probably going to happen. I mean, it's not a bad omen.
I went down a couple times on the show,
it
but it was only very low speeds. And
right.
I just hit the front brakes in wet conditions.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe how quickly that thing goes down.
Oh, motorbikes are insane. They can stop in half the time in dry and double the time in wet. And wow. If you try and make, compared to like a car.
Right.
Because you're basically losing your two wheels. So that, yeah. And the lightness and everything. But yeah, so with the motorcycle, with the test, I remember doing the same thing, but I was 16 and it was just like, I'm going to get this. Waited, though, to do the full license till I was 20.
Right.
And then it was just, there was no turning back. But
oh, yeah. Well, so what I was trying to get out there was that even though I won my wife over.
Yes.
Because I was like, if I get the show, I got to know how to do it.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to be the guy that's hooked up to the back of the car as the lead. You
yeah.
know, like.
Yeah. And you want to be out there in the middle of the thing with them on the walkie going, can we just do one more pass? Can you loop around?
That
lights
was
going down. And you're like, yeah, let's get that
the
shot.
The best experience of my, one of the best experience was the Pursuit Systems are the guys that shot all our riding sequences.
Okay.
They show up in an 18-wheeler with the Porsche Cayenne with the amazing, like, huge rig on top of it, big camera. Guy sits in the back, like, playing, it looks like he's playing Atari with the camera, right?
Oh.
And this guy is, like, a professional driver. They just did Mission Impossible 5 before our show. And we're exchanging Tom Cruise stories and whatnot. But the sun's going down, and they're like, okay, we just want some shots of Damon now. And so we have about 25 miles blocked out on the highway. And I turn to the guy, I'm like, well, how fast do you want me to go? He's like, go as fast as you want, as long as you can maintain that speed. And so I'm gunning it, and I'm kind of like, the funny thing was I was getting emotional because I'm like, I can't believe how awesome this is. And the sun is like blinding my eyes. And then I look in my rearview mirror, and this Porsche is just hammering down, chasing after me. And I'm like, wow,
that's
doing it. Yeah.
Oh, I did a film. This is a little plug for myself, but I did this film called Flight of the Butterflies down in Mexico. It's like an IMAX film. Gordon Pinson, and I'm playing with this girl, Stephanie Sigmund, and we're young lovers in the 70s who are helping track down where butterflies migrate to. And exact same thing, her on the back, and we're just spending about an hour at sunset just getting shots of us on the motorbike. And wow. It's this old 1972 Triumph. It was actually a big piece of shit. And it was British, so they'd flipped the gearing. So I'm gearing with my left, yeah, or braking with my left. And
right.
I'd never done it before, so it was a bit awkward. Stephanie Sigmund just got cast as the new Bond girl. So
wow.
I was pretty happy about that. So I was like, yeah.
That film should get some press now.
That film should get some press.
Yeah.
Well, that film's been doing great. That butterfly one. I don't want to go unplugging it, but it's broken like a shit ton of records.
Oh, really?
Well, the content's just so wonderful, and it was beautifully shot. We're kind of winding down here, dude.
All right,
that's
dude.
Like fucking crazy. Anything you want to go out on? Anything you want to like promote or talk about briefly? Like,
well, definitely. I mean, we're on the precipice of getting picked up.
Great.
For Gangland.
Great.
So, yeah.
Let's talk about this quickly, though,
in.
Before we go out, because
yeah.
I wanted to bring this up and I forgot to write it down. I once in a podcast said, you know, if I'm the lead in a show, it would get picked up. And I know what you said to me is, I agreed when I first heard that, but then my response was, but what if you do a great job and no one sees it?
Yeah.
Finding an audience.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, yeah, for us, there was, we had the hope that they were going to market the hell out of this thing, right? They brought this guy in from New York to shoot these billboards, and they brought a whole LA crew in to shoot a commercial for the show, and we thought it was going to be everywhere. And then when it came to fruition, I didn't see any billboards. It was on the History Channel, I think. From what I heard from the people in the States, they said it was promoted. It was well promoted on the History Channel. They didn't see it on any other avenues.
Got it.
And
now the History Channel does have kind of like its own niche, right? With like the Vikings and stuff. So is it doing all right so far? Do you know?
Yeah, yeah. We're averaging around 1.2.
That's great.
And for cable, it's really good. I mean, Better Call Saul gets 1.2.
Right. That's fantastic, especially because I know it's a lower budget show.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
they
yeah.
don't necessarily...
I mean, well, Vikings is a $5 million show, I think, and
okay.
we were under $1 million in that.
Jesus.
Yeah.
And to the listener, that's very cheap. It might sound like a lot, but that's
yeah.
not
well,
a lot
Well, I think
of money
the production
to make a TV show.
Value, just you see it, and you're like, one of the best things I've seen to come out of Canada, you know, visually on its own. It's just
so what
beautiful.
Can we do on this podcast right now to help you find an audience?
What can we do? I don't know.
Just tell people to watch it. Guys, check this out. It's fantastic. And it's the kind of thing just like this podcast. Like, watch it, tell a friend, post it on your Facebook, you know, and kind of like what you're talking about, Damon. Like, it is hard. Like,
yeah.
the I thought about what you said after, because it's real easy for me to be kind of the arrogant, like, yeah, no, if I blah, blah, blah. But you're totally right. It's not... like this podcast, for example, I put it out there. I bust my ass. It doesn't exist if I don't promote it. Mm-hmm. I don't have a team. But the thing is, I don't have a team, so I don't have to pay them.
Yeah.
I don't pay my... As of now, this podcast makes $0. It's worth it to me and hopefully to the listeners one day. You know, we'll get banners or whatever. You'll click through them and it'll be sustaining. But with a TV show, everybody's got to get paid. Everything's got to happen. So it lives or dies whether people watch it and share it.
A big thing too, and I mean, I'll speak for myself, especially with Canadian stuff. In the past, I know friends are on different shows and I would tune in for a little bit. But I wouldn't actually support it.
Right.
And now I realize, okay, that's the error of my ways. Like, mm-hmm. our industry needs support from everyone, especially the people in the industry. I mean, we can slam it all we want, but it's only going to get better if we promote it.
Totally.
And support it.
And I have noticed a shift. Like, when I was on my first couple shows, pre-social networking, mm-hmm. they promoted me. So it was all this time and energy they were putting into going, you're going to be on this talk show, you're going to be doing this, you're going to be doing this. Since social networking, now I get the emails going, can you please promote this?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, fuck, how? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I get that you're trying to use the, like, Obama getting elected approach mm-hmm. of grassroots, but you still have to do as much as they were doing back in 2000.
Yeah. Well, part of me too was a little bit entitled when it first was happening,
sure.
and knowing that you did this work and you thought the work was really good and it's going to look good. You see a couple cuts, you're like, "All right, I can't wait till this is a huge success." But the other thing is, I realized if you're just accessible to people, like via Twitter or Facebook or whatever, there's such a great wave of positivity where. This is coming full circle where we're all equal, right? And if we help and acknowledge the existence of someone else, then all grow collectively.
100%. And that's the beauty of, like, you get to be an actor, I get to be an actor, Sid gets to be a dancer, Adam's an actor, my brother's a lawyer. Like, we all get the updraft mm-hmm. through just being.
Yeah.
As soon as we grab our entitlements,
I think if you're chasing your dream, then by all means, you're entitled to everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I love it. Damon, thank you so much for coming.
Thank
we
you,
definitely
man.
Have to do this again. Maybe we'll do this when season two happens.
Oh, I'd love to, man.
We'll go for a ride first, and then we'll come back all fresh from that.
Sounds great.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me and Damon. I'm Sean Benson. This is Chatting Between Takes, and that's a wrap.